Street View Podcast is part of the Dallas Public Library's Homeless Engagement Initiative, dedicated to increasing community awareness of issues related to homelessness. The opinions expressed are solely those of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Dallas Public Library or the City of Dallas.
How do you want to see it? What do you want to do? You got it all figured out, straight from your cube. Life's a musical, maybe a carousel. How do you want to see it? What do you want to do? Perception starts with selection. The same streets you walk on, they carry their own view. This is Street View. Most eternal Father, creator of all that is, thank you. Just thank you for the time that you've shown to us. You've given us love. You've given us peace, joy, and hope. We're working toward a cause, God, which is equality. We're grateful for your appearance, God. You're everywhere at the same time. I thank you specifically because of who you are, God, and what you've done in our lives. You've brought us to this very point, and we will recognize you for who you are, God. You are equal part of who we are. We love you, and we thank you for today. And as we go forward, God, we ask that you would ordain peace and joy and love amongst us as a unit, as a whole. It's in the name of Jesus Christ we pray. Amen. Amen. Hello, hello, hello out there. How y'all guys doing? This is Rashad Anthony Dickerson, the host of the Street View Podcast. Today, what we're going to be talking about is the police and the homeless, or those who are without a home. We're going to talk to a guy named Ron Coward. We're also going to talk to a guy named Chris Swafford and Shaquilla Hooks. So we got the whole crew in here, and we're going to talk about that relationship between the police and the homeless. Also, some of the resources, and give you guys insight about what it would be like for you guys to be homeless and try to actually get in contact or actually deal with the police on a day-to-day basis. We're going to also go into a role play where you'll get a first-hand look at what it's like to interact with the crisis intervention team, which is basically a set of individuals who are a part of Dallas Police Department, and their main objective is to interact with the homeless that are not in shelters or those type of environments. So let's start off with talking to Mr. Coward. Mr. Ron Coward, how long have you been with the Dallas Police Department?
I've been with the Dallas Police Department for 45 years, since 1969. I arrived when I got out of the service. I was a combat veteran in Vietnam, and I'd always aspired to be a police officer my entire life since I was maybe 5 years old, and I kept it straight in what I want to do with my life, and this is where I'm at.
As a young man, I looked into all of that. You mind me asking which branch of service you were in?
Well, I was in the Navy, but I was assigned to the 9th Infantry Division in Vietnam. That's the Army, the Mobile Riverine Force. So I was a 50 caliber gunner aboard a small gunboat. It's an ironclad in the Mekong Delta in support of 9th Infantry Division troops.
Wow. What is crisis intervention?
Well, first of all, you have to think of the definition of crisis. A crisis is an event that overwhelms a person's capacity to cope. We believe that homeless persons, and particularly those who are unsheltered, who are living on the streets, are in a state of crisis. And that's why it's appropriate to have a unit within the police department to balance the authoritative mission of the police department, using a therapeutic approach in addressing homeless issues and encouraging people who are living on the streets and to transition them into self-sufficiency.
There's so many things that go along with that. As just an individual who's a civilian in the streets, or just a civilian, plainly just a civilian, what's the mission of the police? I mean, protect and serve?
A police officer has to walk a fine line between protecting the individual rights of that citizen, but also having to react to the greater society or the community who wants them out of their sight, who wants them moved away. When a person calls on any issue, whatever that may mean, if it means the movement of people, the monitoring of conduct, behaviors, whatever it is, you dial 911 with a respected response. It'll be a police officer to do this. There's been a movement in the U.S. over the past several years in looking at the issue of criminalization of the homeless. The Supreme Court ruled several years ago that homeless persons are a protected class. What that simply means is that it created or allowed watchdogs to oversee, if you will, the conduct of police officers interacting with the homeless persons. For example, police officers will trigger the criminal justice system on a homeless person by citing them for conduct such as urinating, defecating, or sleeping in public, public intoxications, and that sort of thing. Now, that law can be applied to anyone, but there's a disproportionate number of those type of offenses directed at homeless persons. Well, they don't have a home to go to the bathroom or to sleep and that sort of thing, so they're going to be more prevalent on the street. And people want the police to do something about it. And the police are very limited in what they can do about homeless persons other than to trigger the criminal justice system, which in effect is criminalizing homeless persons. So with the Dallas Police Department, I can only speak for that, but in the police department, the feeling is that rather than use this type of response, they wanted it balanced by having a crisis intervention unit to balance this out here. We would rather have, and society would rather have, a person within the department who has the authority of the police department, but instead to be able to sit with a person, to engage them, to conduct a professional assessment, and be able to link them either to shelters, to housing programs if that's available, treatment, shelter, that sort of thing. Now, of course, in the U.S., they have the right to say no, and people have to really understand that. So I can talk about through an assessment, I can encourage someone to receive treatment if that's appropriate, or a shelter, or directing them in any way, but they have a right to say no, and you have to respect that. At that particular point, there's nothing more that we can be able to do, but we want to be able to offer that instead of the police going up and hassling someone, getting them up. What would they do with them? It would be jail or citation and that sort of thing, so it's wrong.
Or certain types of, and you said it's wrong, that last word, wrong. Mm-hmm. If I might ask, how many people do you have on staff?
Well, first of all, we have about 8 social workers, but crisis intervention is a unit, but it's made up of 2 sections. One is we have a social service response that responds to police officers and paramedics in the field when they engage someone who they think may have mental health issues or severe self-neglect, particularly the elderly. Some may be chronic callers for 911 system, so they'll refer it to us so that our caseworker can arrive on the scene, do an engagement and assessment, and try to connect that person to the proper services instead of using 911 or emergency services as their primary care. Try to reduce the demands on police. Now, that's one half of the unit. The other half is dedicated, as I said before, with street outreach. And that is also designed to reduce the strain on police, to reduce the confrontational interactions between the homeless and the police. Sometimes police officers feel that their role is to protect and to serve. Protect and serve who? That's the people who live, who own their beats, people who have jobs, who have homes, who have families. Police officers respond to constant victimization. They pull people over for doing bad things. You don't have the time and the inclination to pull someone over that says, I just want to let you know you're driving well. They don't go knock on doors and saying, thank you for working and contributing and paying your taxes. So after a while, a police officer becomes very jaded, extremely cynical, and they take it personally, especially if you arrest and you've got the whole due process that officers have to live under, rules, regulations, stipulations that are dictated by the courts that filter down through your policies and procedures and whatever else. An officer who takes his job personally will feel that these are restraints that keep him from doing his job. How dare you come on to my beat and break into my people's homes, and as far as they're concerned, is you're a scumbag. You're less than human. Get a job. You have to drain. You have to do. You're a blight. Well, you get the idea. They may or may not say that, but the attitude is that I work for hardworking people, and so when people call and say we have a problem with a person, whatever that may be, the officer's going to be very personal about that. But then when you become professional, you have to realize and understand that there is an issue of homelessness throughout the United States of America, in this land of plenty, land of opportunities, that people don't always have a good, fair shake. And you're that person that can change that life for the better as well as for the good. You're not so much a crime fighter as you are a helper. But police officers don't like to look at the fact that I'm a helper. I'm a crime fighter instead.
There's the thing, that servant part is not trained that they should have courtesy with that.
Right, but times are, and this creates a conflict. In this generation today of police officers coming through, the attitudes are really conflicted. The old-timers believe very strongly that I'm not going to tolerate a guy sprawled out on the sidewalk. They're not going to look at whether or not it's a situational issue, whether there be mental illness or addiction. Maybe the guy is in the throes of hallucinations borne about by something that he had no control over. Any number of things. You're a disgrace. The older people want that guy off the sidewalk. The younger officers feel compelled to want to spend more time and try to connect that person. Right. We see this every single day where officers are really conflicted, because in the old days, in my day growing up, is that we did not have the social services that we have today. A police officer had to make a decision. For instance, with domestic violence issues, it's if I have to come back out here, you need to settle it. If I have to come back out here, someone's going to jail. Yeah. Well, today's police officers have a lot of resources and a lot of people looking over their shoulders to ensure that you say and do the right things. The same thing goes with people on the streets. And that's another reason why our unit is in demand. Yes. And why we're really flooded with requests from officers who don't want to put homeless persons in jail.
So if you will, you're almost like another social service in a sense.
It's a social service. And I have to constantly remind other officers and even myself is that, you know, I'm not just a cop. I've got to react to that community. He wants me to do something about it. But I'm going to do it in the professional, humane way. I want that person to be touched, but I want that person to be guided into the right services that can get that person to become self-sufficient and into whatever services that that person believes that they need, not what I think they need, what that person feels that I need. And it's very important to know what's going on in that person's head so I can do that.
So I'm looking at a lot of the things you're saying, or I'm hearing them and I'm trying to process them. You getting me? You're taking me fast, Mr. Ron. You're taking me fast. If I was a homeless guy, I'd be ready to go, man, and get some services. Wait, I am a homeless guy. Okay. I'm looking at this and I'm asking about some of the individuals you talked about. You talked about those individuals who are muttering to themselves and are walking. And I stayed at one of the local homeless shelters, the Bridge. The Bridge houses a lot of those type of individuals. But there are so many different types of individuals when you look at homeless. There's so many different categories. They are categorized. Some of them don't go into the shelter. Why do you think that is?
There's a lot of reasons. We have to know and recognize that, because we're not herding people into those shelters. It's against everything we stand for to go out on the streets and herd people. You might as well call them sweeps, and we're not going to engage in that. It has to be an individual at that one time. But there is a resentment, because the only option you have for housing is going to be a shelter. That person cannot be, and we will not take them there unless we've assessed them thoroughly, and that's where they want to go, or we'll put them there overnight so that we can take them in for treatment in the next day. And we're part of that discharge process, so we can ensure that when they get back to that shelter, or they get in that shelter, that they can do recovery. Now, to answer your question, most of these shelters in Dallas and the Bridge in particular are overcrowded. They're chaotic. In there, you have a mass movement of human beings constantly moving. You have people who are mentally ill that are not medicated. Yes. You have people who are mentally ill that are medicated and are very fragile. Yes. You have people who are both addicts and mentally ill who are going through treatment and they're not yet stabilized. Okay. You have folks that have no mental illness or addiction disorders whatsoever. They're just trying to hang on. They've got jobs to go to, but they don't have enough money to get into an apartment or housing or anything. You've got this huge mixture of humanity in there.
It's almost spilling over, in a sense.
It is spilling over. So now with that, you've got to understand this, and you have to listen closely on this, is that a nudge of an elbow, a touching of a finger to finger, an arm can trigger a violent response. Somebody eating can look up and see someone looking at them. Hey, you looking at me? What are you looking at me for? You want some of this? Next thing you know, there's a fight that goes on. At nighttime, there are people who, for whatever reasons, have nightmares at night, or they have to get up. They do. They stir about. Any number of things. People who may wake up in the throes of hallucinations. The problem is that can start a fight. It can start any number of things, and it can create a big ripple effect with that. Especially a person who has just gone through treatment and they expect to do recovery, it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to do proper recovery in that type of an atmosphere.
I can agree. I can concur because, I mean, I actually, staying at the shelter, once had a guy, like, sleep, get naked while he was asleep. And, like, and he's next to me and he's still, like, in transition of, you know, kind of that groggy feeling when you sleep. And it's like, bro. And I'm up. I'm in school at the moment, so I'm studying. And it's like, bro, you're naked, bro, and you're next to me. Wake up. And so you do have different personality levels. And me being a person who's, I guess you would say, lucid in a sense, or has sense in a sense. Or when I say sense, I mean somebody that understands the difference between being passive, aggressive, and assertive. And so I'm almost like, at that position, hey, I need to tell somebody that this guy is naked and I don't want him to wake up. And if he is mentally ill, inflict whatever his desire is rather than try to sensibly work that situation out. So I understand that. We're going to get into it. I have Miss Shaquilla Hooks, who has been homeless for about a year. I'd like for her to kind of give a quick summary about her experiences here on the streets. And also, once she's finished with that, we'll begin with the role play from Mr. Round Coward.
I've been on the streets off and on since the age of 13. It's not the easiest thing, but my main thing is you have to learn how to survive. Me, with the homeless society, I feel as if it's survival of the fittest. That's when that tactic kicks in. And if you're not strong mentally, physically, or emotionally, you're not going to survive out here. Me, I'm to the point where, yes, I will break down. I have mental issues. I have emotional issues. I have physical issues. But I refuse to give up and let society win. I refuse to let society put that label on me to the point where I believe it myself. No, I know I'm worth so much more and I can do so many things in life. It's just I have to have that person there by my side that is willing to not only help me, but give me that path to take and show me what's right and what's wrong. Personally, I've dealt with DPD. I've dealt with them multiple times. I've been kicked out of my encampment. I've had all my stuff thrown away by DPD and not tell me where it's at. I have a son and I'm out here while he's with my mother. And I refuse to let him grow up knowing that his mom was considered as a worthless bum or a scumbag or anything not worth human. I am very intelligent. I just choose not to show it. I've been diagnosed with bipolar, manic depressive, paranoid schizophrenic, and multiple personality disorder. But at the same time, society does not realize that if they knew my past, they would take a totally different outlook on homeless societies. Multiple homeless people, yes, we have mental issues, but at the same time, you cannot let your mental issues run your life. It's not that I don't know how, it's that I'm not ready to take that step. I'm afraid that I've been offered multiple things, multiple housing options. I'm afraid that since I've been on the streets for so long and that's all I know, that once I get indoors and I get in a stable environment, that I'm going to end up right back out here.
Okay. I got a question.
Yes, sir.
You said you dealt with DPD often. Have you ever dealt with crisis intervention?
I go to crisis intervention for help. Safety patrol. They know me. I've talked to the crisis team there. I've talked to Chris personally, and he does anything and everything he can. I've been to Green Oaks, Timberlawn, Hickory Trails, Terrell State Hospital. I've been to Parkland, Baylor. They know me. I'm learning how to control my things. I've been off of my medication for 3 months, and people think I'm not functioning right. No, I'm functioning well. It's to the point where I can walk around with a smile on my face, and it's not a fake smile. It's a real smile. I'm learning how to pray to God. I'm learning how to take what I know from the streets and apply it to everyday life. It's gotten to the point where when I first got to Texas, I've only been here for a little bit over a year. When I first got here, I got off a Greyhound. There was a mother waiting outside for a ride or just standing there, and I had a feeling she was homeless. I had over $500 worth of clothes in my suitcase at the time, and majority of them I did not wear. I gave her a $200 pair of shoes with the matching outfit and told her that's what I can do for right now. It's gotten to the point where I'm walking down the street 2 weeks after that, and I have $40 in my hand, and there is a mother and child outside, and the child is complaining she's hungry. The mother is trying to do the best she can. I hand over all my money and tell her, get her something to eat, and you eat too. I do what I can do. I know that because I've been in the same position and I'm back in it right now. But at the same time, I refuse to let people go without. If I know I can help you and if I know I can do what I can, then I'm going to be there for you.
It's intrinsic. That's what we call humility. To be able to say, I have and I see another human and I'd like that person to be on the same level or equal, or at least I have the ability to help that person. Why not do it? What we have here now is a role play about to occur. And seeing that you dealt with crisis intervention, Ms. Hooks, I'd like for Mr. Coward and Ms. Hooks to begin this role play and for our listeners to understand what this type of interaction would be, because this is the side nobody sees. This is the side where the homeless and the law actually meet. People are really, really chatty about it. I've seen blogs about it where they begin talking about homelessness and going to other things.
At the same time, they don't. Heard about it, but they've never heard the actual conversations that we have. It's not always bad and it's not always a violent conversation. No. If you know how to communicate with that person, if you know what that person goes through and knows how to deal with those type of people, then the conversation can go smoothly and you can get the help you need.
Y'all have the conversation. Mr. Coward, if you would.
Well, in order to put it in the right perspective, we'd have to understand how we were able to come to this point of engagement. The reason for that is that we don't walk down the street or drive down the street looking for mentally ill people. It'd be impossible. It can't be humanly done unless that person is doing something that would put himself and others into some sort of an endangerment mode. We won't know whether that person is homeless or not if we walk down the street or pass them. A person sitting next to you on the bus could be homeless, maybe not, maybe mentally ill, maybe not. The kid at school, a student next to your own son and daughter could be mentally ill or maybe even homeless. A lot of students or a lot of teachers may not be aware that child in that classroom goes to a shelter at night instead of home. So it depends. We would never engage with you about the issue of homelessness or mental illness with someone unless you're in some sort of a situation that would draw us to you. So the situation would have to be that we would encounter you in an encampment, or that you ask for help, you summoned us, and then you would have to be very specific with what you want, because we do have safeguards designed to protect you. We can't infringe upon your rights. We can't make an assumption or try to put you somewhere where you don't need to be. You have a right to be self-sufficient. As long as you're walking down the street, it's no one's business where you're going or where you're coming from. You can sit like anyone else and sit and watch people pass by. They can do that. So to put us in a role scenario, you would have to set something up for us to have an encounter. Otherwise, we'll be talking philosophically about homelessness, mental health issues, and so forth. Secondly, if we do get into an engagement assessment, since I know who you are, I don't want to get into a public domain anything about you that you would want to reveal. Nobody needs to know that. And we have laws that protect you, so I don't want you to give up anything about yourself in this type of a situation. But in real life, I would be asking you very personal questions about, are you homeless?
Yes, I am.
Yes. And then why are you homeless?
I'm homeless for multiple reasons, not only for the mental issues, but because of family issues. My son is one of the reasons I'm out here on the streets. I refuse to be in the house with the way my past is. I was on drugs for multiple years, and I can't have that around my son, let alone I can't have it around the rest of my family.
And then the question, of course, it'd be more in depth with this, such as, who is your provider? Now, remember, you don't give that out in this domain, but I would be asking you who your provider is, what type of medications have been prescribed, and I will ask a personal question such as, are you taking your medications? If you had an imaginary line in which you yourself would consider your normal operating baseline, where are you, above or below that? That could show either agitation, frustration, anger, and that sort of thing, or it could show depression and any number of things that can attribute in a natural way to despair to your functionality.
It's, and with me personally, I'd say, I mean, I'm putting this off for the record. I don't care who knows what I go through. Personally, I put myself out there with information that can be used to help me and others, because if I know for a fact that I'm not the only one who goes through this on a daily basis. And there's probably someone out there who's going through it 10 times worse than me. So me personally, no, I don't take my medication. Why? Because it makes me feel like a totally different person. I feel as if I shouldn't have to be on medication to be considered as normal. Mm-hmm. I feel like they use medication as not only a stabilizer, but to make you feel like you're a normal person and that's the way life should be.
Well, I can tell by talking with you that you're a very intelligent person. And believe me, I'm not patronizing you when I say that. I think everybody at this table can understand that. You're very articulate and open with your emotions. In a real situation here, you may not be open with me. You may not want to tell me. You don't know who I am. You don't know how that information is to be used.
And with that response, I would have to say, if I feel comfortable with you, I'm more than willing to open up and express my needs and my concerns, knowing that in the long run, I will get the help that I desire. Mm-hmm. Knowing that in the long run, when I get that help, I can also not only get help, but I can refer someone else to you to get the same help if they need it.
All right. I certainly understand that, of course. The next phase of questioning I would ask you is, after I've heard from you, and you will only give me what you want me to know now, and I want that to be clear, is that not everybody is going to be so open about these things. Thirdly, is that I would ask you, why are you living in this box? Now, the reason for that is not to humiliate you by any means, but it's very important that we do what we call reality counseling or engagement here. There's no illusions about this. If you're living in a box, you're living in a box. With the resources that are out here, and we do understand the issues of overcrowded and chaotic shelters, but we're not going to reveal that we know that to you. We want you to tell me as to why are you, after I've asked you, are you homeless? Yes. Why are you homeless? How long have you been homeless? And why are you living in a box? So can you...
It's not that I choose to be homeless. Mm-hmm. It's me. I've been homeless since the age of 13. Growing up on the streets, that's all I know. And it's not that I refuse to go to a shelter to stay. I'm more than willing to go to a shelter, but I have to be in a shelter where I know they're going to help me. I know that in the long run, I will have my needs met and I'm not going to be another statistic. And right now, that's how I feel, as if I'm a statistic. And I feel like not only do I get disregarded by the color of my skin, by my sex, by my sexuality, I feel as if my mental issues have a big part to do with that. Who I am as a person have a big part to do with that. And where I go has a major part to do with that. I want to be in a shelter or in a place where I know I'm not going to be judged. I know I'm going to get help. I know I'll have people to talk to. I know that there's people going there with the same issues as me. And personally, I don't stay in a shelter. I sleep on the streets. If I'm not on the streets, then I'm in somewhere where it's not viewable or not visible to public property or public, but it's also the police know I'm there, or they know that someone's staying there. Like recently, I've been to jail for sleeping in public. I was staying in the parking garage at the convention center. Police know we're there, and not only do they come and check on us now, they keep an eye on our stuff when we're not there. And I mean, that's how I view as society should be, is not, you're not criminalizing the homeless, or you're not making homeless feel like criminals and arresting them because they're on the streets or because they don't have a roof over their heads. I feel as if, yes, you should be able to get that help. You shouldn't go to jail for sleeping where you feel comfortable. My main thing is, what's public and what's private? If there's no signs up that say this is private property, then, I mean, most people would consider it as public property. And I just want to know, I mean, where would you go if those signs aren't there, or if the signs are there? Say there's no sign there and you fall asleep there and the cops arrest you. How are you going to arrest me when there's no notice or a visible warning that says this is private property? For all we know, it can be public property and you just don't want us there. And that's my main thing is I've been arrested for going and sleeping. I fell asleep on the sidewalk and I've been told I have to get my stuff and move or else I'm going to jail. I've been arrested for not having an ID. That's my main thing. I'm homeless. How do I get an ID without having that place where I can go or the information that I need? Because I just got my birth certificate. And my main thing is there, you cannot put a time limit on when you need to get an ID. If you don't have the necessary documents, you don't have them. You have to work and take it step by step by step just to get what you need. I mean, why arrest us for what we don't have or what we do have? If it's not illegal, why arrest us? And that's my main worry.
Well, I think you also reiterated the conflict issue I told you about before, where police officers today, it was years ago, an officer personally found your conduct to be such that he's going to put you in jail. It's punitive. He doesn't care how you arrive there. It's that it's an offense against the public. Today's police officers don't feel that way. Now, let me explain. Some police officers realize that shelters are not the best place for you. We have to understand why a person would live in an encampment. We have to be able to justify why you live in an encampment before we can start getting you out of that encampment.
My answer to that would be, me being a female, there's not many shelters you can find in Dallas where you can go. Like, say, for instance, that female is pregnant or she has kids. You can't go to the bridge with kids. You can't go to the bridge and be pregnant. You have to be certain ages. You have to have certain identification. What if you don't have that identification? So your main thing is you're on the streets until you can get it.
That's right. We've noticed that the characteristics of homeless. Now, we're going to talk about the chronic unsheltered homeless populations more. They tend to not have IDs. They get thrown away, they get lost, they get removed, they get taken up, they get thrown out, any number of things. We've happened to find that, statistically speaking, very few people who live on the streets have ID, yet that is a prerequisite for many of these shelters. You can't get in there. It's so tragically ironic that people would be expected to furnish an ID.
Mr. Kyle, we're having good conversation. And we're going back and forth. A lot is being said. But I would like to stop and make sure that the laws are clarified, that we understand who owns public space. I also want to ask, you know, what are the rules? It seems like there's a lot going on as far as discretion is concerned, but the laws are really what matter. And so would you expound on some of those laws?
Well, of course, a lot of discretion can be used with a police officer. That's probably his greatest tool there, is that we live in a democratic society in which an officer can use discretion as long as, one, it does not violate the Constitution, that it does not, his actions, violate the law or the policies of the police department. Discretion has to be used in a humanitarian way. Now, they could follow without discretion. An officer not using discretion at all would have to enforce the laws to the fullest letter, and you don't want an officer like that. They would have to take a one-on-one. Good or bad, that's the way discretion is used. And that's why there's a lot of ambiguity in terms of enforcement. In the long run, you don't know whether it's against the law or not if you have a tolerant police officer one day and a strict officer the next. But that is using that discretion. If an officer was going to use non-discretion, he'd be rounding everybody up constantly and creating a lot of problems. I won't get too much into that.
So who owns public space?
If there's no complainant, if there's no one complaining to the police and you're out of sight, and see, I'm using a lot of discretion in saying this. I'm not following any letter of the law, but I will tell you that from the police officer's viewpoint, if you're sleeping in a subterranean environment, no one is around, maybe around the convention centers and so forth. Officers may be aware that you're there, but they also know that by coming there and getting you up takes a tremendous amount of effort on that department, on that officer's part. What is the rationale for doing that? Is there crime being committed? Are there rapes and assaults in that area? And you may be a victim or you may be a perpetrator. There's got to be some motivation for that officer to go out of his way to locate you and get you up on your feet, asking you for ID and hassling you and moving you on. Now, if you moved on, where are you going to go? The vast majority of officers know this, and they pressure us with this as well. When they get you to, quote, move on, where are you going to move too. There's not many places. We've had officers that says we've had a lot of complaints here. Go down over here, and he'll point to an overpass or something. You'll move down there, and you'll get hassled even more so because you're on somebody else's property and such. So it creates huge problems. You become good cop, bad cop, the same way as you were describing during the break about security guards. What's their personal toleration for this? How much pressure are they getting to react to this sort of thing? So, see, it creates havoc with people who are trying to figure out what to do. I want to do the right thing. You want to do the right thing, but you don't know unless it's clarified. Now, as far as ID is concerned, it's not against the law to not have ID. You are not compelled to have ID. However, if you've got ID and you fail and you refuse to produce ID, then that can lead to other things, such as you're not going to get a ticket for unless you're driving a vehicle without your driver's license. If the officer feels that he could go either way, your attitude will determine that for that officer. For all he knows, you're a wanted felon. You could be any number of things, and the officer doesn't feel comfortable releasing you back out on the streets when he feels that you may be a potential danger.
The other guest I have here is Mr. Chris Swafford. Chris, could you give just a brief summary about your experiences with homelessness?
I was born in Beaumont, Texas. I became homeless. Well, I've been struggling mostly all of my life, not with the homeless issue, but more or less the poverty in America. You know, poverty struck our family real hard. I went to TYC as a youth. So, you know, when I got out at 21, you know, from the age of 12 to 21.
TYC?
Texas Youth Commission.
Okay.
When I got out at 21, I found the harsh reality of a world. I grew up in a structured environment. So, you know, for me, discipline and structure was proper. It was demanded.
Fundamental.
Yeah. But when I got out, I noticed, you know, the world was a lot different than what I was used to. When I got out, it was an automatic struggle. I used to have to panhandle with my sister at a post office just to eat because my mother, she was a drug addict. She was addicted to dope. I used to have to steal just to eat.
Dope.
You know, so I've known the struggle ever since I was 21. Well, ever since I was a kid, but more or less 21. I moved to California and needless to say, I became addicted to cocaine.
Yes,
you know what I'm saying? But in the process of this whole transaction, I wasn't homeless at that point in time, but I knew the struggle.
Yes, sir.
I had a house. I had two cars. I had two jobs. You know what I'm saying? And I was still doing illegal stuff on the side.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So I knew the struggle, and the money was there. It was just how to get it. And now, because I was addicted to cocaine, I had to move. I was gang affiliated, you know, so I had a lot of my friends and family that was passing away, you know, things like that. And I felt like I would have been next. So I left.
Yes, sir.
I came to Dallas. I can't lie. This is the most that I've ever seen homeless.
Yes.
Like, this is the I come to Dallas and I was surprised to see how many homeless people, how many people would be standing on street corners asking for money. Like,
yes.
I've seen it everywhere that I go, but not a vast majority like how you see in Dallas.
It's abundant here.
It is. It really is. Since I've been out here since 2006, I've been off and on homeless. You know, I get up on my feet and then I fall on hard times.
So you're off and on homeless since 2006 in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been around since before, like, the bridge was open. And
I was around when Stupak was still feeding. I was around when the Resource Center was open.
Okay. The Resource Center. Would you tell us a little bit about the Resource Center?
The Resource Center, man, it was, for a homeless person to say, it was the place to be.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? It was your shelter. It was your food source. It was your shower. It was your mental health issue place.
Yeah.
You know, it was your bus pass when you needed transportation.
Yeah.
It was just everything that you needed was in that one space.
Okay.
During the rain or the harsh winter, you know, we would sleep inside the building. But then again, I could also say that there wasn't as many homeless people as you see now. Because when they built the bridge, they broadcasted it on TV. which allowed people from New York, Michigan, Florida, all different places in the U.S. to come to this one spot.
Okay.
So, but when we were over there, I mean, everybody that came to the resource center was able to sleep on the inside. We right. fit everybody in there.
And that's not so with the bridge, in a sense, or any other shelters. There are so many stipulations. Individuals are not able to, everybody's not able to fit there.
It's a hard situation, but it's a harsh reality.
Yeah.
Like when I became homeless on the 31st of last month, I couldn't get into the bridge because I didn't have the proper identification.
Wow.
Which I kind of understood, you know, okay, you can't hold me here because what if I do have a warrant and the police come looking for me?
You do need to be identified.
It's like you're harboring a fugitive.
Okay.
I can understand that. But, you know, when I spoke to the guy that runs the bridge now, I was like, okay, you know, I don't care about staying in here. Can I come eat? Can I come shower? You
right,
know,
right,
I need
right.
my basic necessities. So basically, you leaving me back out on the streets again to fend for myself. So what would happen if I went and robbed Walmart? Or what happened if I went and robbed somewhere to go get something to eat?
Yeah, that's logical in a sense.
You know
almost.
What I'm saying? Some homeless people have to do this in order to survive sometimes.
That's true.
And I feel like, you know, you spent so many millions of dollars to build this place, but you're not holding what you say you're capable of holding.
Okay. There was a hype that never got met, in a sense. And when you were at the resource center, you saw this happen.
Everything got met.
I want to unleash you in a sense, let you loose. With Mr. Cowell, because I know you have a lot of interesting questions. You have a lot of know-how about being homeless
mm-hmm.
and also just vast knowledge about it. And there are individuals who see it from the law side. They see it from the civilian side. And some individuals see it from the homeless side, and they may actually be able to get certain resources from you. Before we go in. Yeah, go ahead.
You know what's weird is for a homeless person to say this, it's kind of a intriguing situation because I can't say I see it from the law side.
Yes.
But I've done enough studies with the police, like standards, how they work,
yes.
you know, things like that. But I also see it from a civilian side because before I became homeless now, I hadn't been on these streets in almost 3 years.
Yes.
So I kind of see myself as I've been a civilian.
Yes, sir.
I've also been homeless, but I've never been part of the law.
Yeah.
But I see how they work, and I've dealt with them almost every day of my life.
Well, Mr. Coward is familiar with the resource center, and I'd like him to kind of explain about that experience with it.
Well, before I went to work for Crisis Intervention, and I just retired from the Dallas Police Department, I was manager of the Day Resource Center.
I remember you.
Do you? I thought you looked familiar, but I wasn't going to open that door.
I remember you.
But the Day Resource Center was made up of advocates. It was a one-stop shop that had MetroCare, Parkland.
Dentistry.
It had everything there. It target populations would be those people who didn't want to give your name. You could come in and sign in any name that you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted you in there. When you came in, you had the freedom to be in the back if you want to. You could wash your clothes. You could take showers. You could access services. We could guide you into anything. The VA was there with a compensated work therapy programs and so forth. The population wasn't near as big and visible as it is now. However, with the bridge was being built, what happened with the bridge? And I do not work for the bridge. I don't want to be defensive or beat up on the bridge or anything like that, because
yes,
they're a resource center. They're a resource for
they
us.
They are helping.
Today, they are. But when the city of Dallas had so much pride in building this facility, it was meant to be targeting the very people that we work with, the unsheltered homeless who had the characteristics of frustration, anger, being on the streets, being down, needing services, unrestricted services. I could go on and on. It was designed for the homeless person who was really down on their luck with every conceivable circumstances helping them. It was a one-stop facility. The problem is that it went out nationwide.
It was broadcasted on TV.
It went out everywhere. They wanted everyone to come there. the shelters, the traditional shelters, began emptying out their bunks. They told people, even though they were, you know, these shelters are not free. You have to pay $5, $8, $10 a night for these public shelters, with the exception of Salvation Army, a Union guy. But anyway, they would tell people, you need help. You need more help than just coming here and sleeping. Go to the bridge. Everybody went to the bridge. We started seeing signs at the Greyhound bus station. People were getting off these buses wanting to know where the bridge was. There were people that had mental health issues, addiction disorders, whatever, from Montana to Idaho, wow, to New York City, who were coming in here looking for, because it was 24-hour service. You could eat at night. You could have a bed waiting for you, a warm bed, a hot shower, and a hot meal. I can go on. You understand that. So it became a victim of its own success.
I'd like for you to go ahead, Chris, and ask as many questions as you'd like, but I do want to say a few things myself, and I'm writing questions down as we go.
Now, with the bridge, I can't think of his name, but I dealt with someone from Crisis Intervention. And what it was, you know, when I needed somewhere to be, he took me and my baby mama, he took us to the shelter, to the bridge, and got us actually in. He helped us get off the streets and into a bed there. Now, you can't even walk in the bridge and stay. It's like, okay, you send us to the mission, or the men to the mission. I was just staying at the mission the other night, and it was so hard because you have overflow. You have actual beds there, but now you have overflow to where people are laying on concrete, you know, in the chapel. So how can you expect someone to not be homeless? You see what I'm saying? If I know that I can't get into a shelter, but I have to sleep on concrete anyway, why not sleep outside?
Especially with all kind of rules and regulations.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's hard because, like I was expressing earlier with the resource center, it was like he said, it was a one-stop shop for everything. Everything you needed. And now it's like, if you want your ID, you got to go to the stew pot. If you want a meal, you got to go to the bridge. If you want this, you got to go to certain places to get it.
And it almost causes individuals to tramp, if in a sense.
It causes a lot of people to break.
To break. Because you have to go all over. In essence, everybody is self-sufficient. And a homeless man's self-sufficiency is going from place to place in order to gather those resources. Mm-hmm. And some don't even have that drive to go for those resources because it's like, man, why? What's the sense of it?
If I feel good about myself, you know, to where, hey, you know, I'm fixing to go get in this shelter, man. You know, I need help. But I feel confident enough to bring myself without anyone's help, or, you know, you come and tell me, sir, you know, I need you to come up off the streets and I need you to come and try to get into a shelter. I feel good about myself enough to pull myself up, to pull myself to that shelter. But when I get to that shelter, I still get denied. Why would I bring myself back up to do it all over again? At the end of that day, I'm like, man, I can't get in. So what's the point of me even trying?
Right. There's a despair that Mr. Ron was talking about.
Exactly. And it leads a lot of people to the panhandling. How are you going to eat?
You have to ask.
My mama always told me a closed mouth does not get fed.
Everybody mama tell them that, man. That's real.
And I kid you not, when you can't get into a shelter, how are you going to eat? You have to have money. How are you going to get money if you don't ask? So it leads a lot of people to think that all homeless people are just bums because they panhandle. And that's not the case. You see what we show you. You see what I allow you to see. If I want you to see that I'm homeless, believe me, you'll see it. If I don't want you to think that I'm homeless, believe me, I dress in a tuxedo and I'll still be homeless and you would never know it.
You wouldn't. Bro, it's crazy because me right now, or this situation, I've dealt with a lot of the situations we've talked about. I've dealt with DPD as far as sleeping in public. I've dealt with, you know, them saying, well, like Mr. Ron said, well, they'll say, go over here or go over there. And I've had one guy say, well, listen, the car auction auto, and this is a police officer, the auction will hire people. Do you have an ID? Go down to the auction right off this train station, and then they'll put you on. So it's not that, you know, oh, there are no resources for the homeless.
Resources are there.
It's getting the resources.
Exactly.
And are those resources applicable to what I desire? Don't get me wrong. That's what we do as people, period. My question to you, Chris, and also to you, Mr. Coward, is what's the solution to homelessness?
Honestly, there is a difference between being homeless and homelessness. Being homeless is you just don't have nowhere to go. Like, I just got kicked out of a boarding home. I'm homeless. I don't deal with homelessness. The state of being, it's like a state of mind. But what I do feel is if there was more resources or more buildings, like I walk around downtown every day and I see countless numbers of abandoned buildings that are for lease, that are for rent. The Plaza Motel, right on the other side of the freeway from the resource center. They were talking about opening that up for homeless families and letting them pay so much rent a month to stay like an apartment. I feel like, honestly, if some of these buildings or some of these hotels that are broke down and, you know, can be re-innovated or whatever, fixed up and help the homeless. If everyone is so considerate about people sleeping on sidewalks and sleeping in public places that is not for habitat, help us, you know what I'm saying? Get us somewhere to go. Not all resources are helpful to us. So find a resource that can help us.
Okay, Mr. Coward, how do you feel about homelessness? What do you think the solution is?
Well, first of all, when you talk about homelessness, it's an overall state, all right, but it takes away the individual. You really have to look at the characteristics of homelessness with despair, mental illness, substance abuse disorders, as well as domestic violence issues, lack of housing, and that sort of thing. The most pressing thing would be the lack of supportive housing programs here in the U.S. There are a lot of folks who get SSI, disability money, but they are not able to function. They're still going to have an environment in which they have to have supportive services that can help them to remain self-sufficient.
And so what we'll do is we'll look at that. We'll look at that as we continue. And I like for everybody who's here, that means everybody that's in this room, everybody that's listening, everybody that's paying attention to tune in with us again, because Mr. Ron has given us some great things to think about. You now have a perspective from somebody who is a police officer, who's an officiating authority figure. I've also looked at those hoops. I've been the guy who has had to jump through those hoops. I've jumped through multiple hoops. And at this moment, if you see me, you wouldn't recognize, hey, that's the homeless guy. No, because I'm the student at the school. Shaquille Hooks is the female who's sharing poetic inspiration in the workshops. We have everybody that's here as an individual. Christopher is the guy who's sharing his life expectancy. When you look at this guy, you'll see the guy who looks like the biker, who's being himself and is an individual. So what we have here is a set of individuals who are communicating in a way in which will evoke hope, inspiration, and humility toward one another. And also, we're displaying this as a group outwardly so that others might understand that our diversity here in America is linked to the communication between each other. We appreciate everybody taking their time and coming out. Big kudos to you, Mr. Coward. Thanks for coming out. Chris? Big kudos to you, Shaquilla. Big, big, humongous kudos to my sister. That's my baby. So, with all this being said,
we really want to thank you too, bro, because you sat down and took the time to listen to us, man. You took the time to understand us. You've been in our situation, and we really thank you and Miss Jasmine too. You know what I'm saying? I never even thought the librarians would, you know what I'm saying, come and sit down and listen to the things that we said. You know what I'm saying? We deal with crisis intervention every day, so to deal with y'all, man, is like a pleasure, bro.
And, bro, you know I love you. And I have to thank you, because if it wasn't for you and Jasmine, the voice of the homeless people would not be getting out to society. They would not know what we go through. And I God bless you. That's all I can say.
And to everyone that's paying attention to us out there, you know what I'm saying? I really want to thank y'all, too. If y'all really understand where we coming from and y'all can help us, man, please do. We really need help. We really need understanding. We really need the knowledge that everyone out there has. So if y'all got help and resources, please, please, from the life of us, help us.
I do want to read something, a conversation I had with my mom just now. I let my mom know what we're working on. And I told her, right now I'm working on a podcast at the library. We're trying to change the world like you taught me to. She told me she's happy I'm doing something positive. And I told her what this is about. She told us it's amazing. And she knows I don't do well with authority figures. She knows I have a very smart mouth and I like to mouth off and backtalk. But at the same time, Mr. Coward is someone I've never met him, but meeting him today, he is someone that understands us. He is someone that not only understands, but he's someone who's willing to help. And my mom, she's not only happy I'm doing this, she is happy that we're spreading the word, and she's spreading the word. She is telling her friends and the family that we're doing this to help people. And for that, Mom, I don't know if you're going to listen, but I do love you. And
hi, Mom.
Everyone says hi.
All we're doing is trying to change one life at a time.
And that's all we can do is try.
And so with that said, as a man who honors God and does what is best, what is righteous, what is truthful, I like to pray this whole thing out and join us this meeting here, if y'all will. Let us bow. Father God in heaven, we come now as a unit, as a whole, as a set of people who are actually interconnected. Our purpose for being is to glorify you through communication, through sharing one another's experiences, and just doing what you asked us to do. You know, love God first with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, and then love your neighbor as yourself, you know. We say, just like we've been taught, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And we learn all these things from you through inspiration, through wisdom, and through, you know, kind ways and love and peace and joy and hope. So we just want to just lift you up in a minute and, you know, thank you for joining us and having us to walk, talk, and breathe, because we don't do it on our own. So with that said, we thank you for those who have been inspiration and have shown love. One man, Jesus Christ, talked about something, and it's been talked about for years at a time. It's been talked about over 2,000 years. One man had the inspiration to try to reach down and touch, and his one touch became a ripple effect, which has changed and has shaped both history and the future. And so with that, in this moment, we thank you for being you and giving us Jesus Christ. And we pray this prayer in the name of Jesus Christ and ask that you would keep and protect not only everybody that's here, but everybody that shows humility toward one another. It's in Jesus Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Street View. You can visit us online at streetviewpodcast.com. Tune us in again next time for more discussion.